Thank you very much to the organizers of this symposium, the Casa de las Americas and the Center for Studies on the Americas. I'm very happy to be here with you again and to be participating in this. In this symposium on Malcolm X. My topic may seem extremely broad, and I admit it is, but the reason it is because I sincerely feel that some of the influences, mutual influences of the Caribbean, of Africa, Islam, women, and students need to be addressed more than they have been so far. I see this as not separate entities, but rather as overlapping and intertwined influences on Malcolm's life and also to Malcolm X from those respective cases. I hope I will be successful in trying to show you what I mean. I should start by letting you know how I began to be interested in Malcolm X. It was just by accident that my family, trying to escape from the gang wars of the South Bronx in New York, bought a house in a place called East Elmhurst, Queens, which was a neighborhood in transition from Italian and Irish Catholic to African American and Caribbean blacks mainly. My father, in trying to move us away from what he considered the low life of the South Bronx, never thought that I would fall under the influence of a person who was feared by so many and pictured in the media as being such a difficult and terrible terrorist, racist figure as Malcolm X. Well, fortunately for me, two doors down from our house was another similar house. Not similar, all the houses on the block were exactly the same. You could take a machine gun and light it up and you hit all the same windows. And this house, two doors from mine, was the house of another Muslim family. And in that house, Malcolm X had a room. It was a custom that the Muslim families would live in communal style until they married and had children. So he was living there in the house of a family called the Muley family. And those were Islamic converts, members of the Nation of Islam. Now, I as a teenager didn't know anything about who he was, but his presence was a very imposing one. And you've all seen his picture, but I'm a short person, as you can see. He was not only tall, but also very simple, and at the same time, the type of person you have to notice when he walks down the street, even if it's in a crowd, not because of his height, but because of his presence. I can't exactly explain what I mean by that, but he certainly was a charismatic figure, and at the same time, a very simple person. I hope I can get you to get a feeling of how it was for us, as especially from families like mine, where you are seen and not heard. All of a sudden, there is a person who we later found out was somebody of importance, recognized as having importance, which to us was not negative importance, who would sit down on the stoop and talk to the teenagers, talk to the kids, you know, and just talk to us like people, which we were not accustomed to having from even our parents in most cases at that time, especially not in families like mine. So the ironic thing is that many Islamic people in the neighborhood, Sunni Islamic people from Trinidad, from Africa, from other places, were very much afraid of Malcolm for two reasons. They felt that the so-called black Muslims, they couldn't relate to. It was different from what they expected. Many times they visited the mosque, and I did myself, and it was like no other mosque I had ever seen. It, except for the fact that it had shares at the time that we visited, and it had the star and crescent symbols facing the east. You know, it was more like a lecture hall. It was obviously a political center rather than a mosque in the usual sense that I was familiar with and that they were familiar with. So they said, this is not Islam. And in addition, you're going to get yourself in trouble if you read that newspaper openly. If you go to those places, if you sign those things, you'll be in bad trouble. And don't forget, this is shortly after the McCarthy era, when they had seen people, you know, lose their jobs with or without qualifications. So they were really afraid, and they were warning us to stay away from Malcolm and such things. Of course, we didn't do it. Well, some people did, but fortunately, we didn't. So we had to literally sneak the newspaper in the house amongst our books and read it. Now, this was out of... It was not my father's usual behavior to be like this, because he would usually say, let's discuss things, read it, we'll discuss it, we'll have a discussion as long as you support your ideas. But this was something that was too close to home, and he was really out of form and never changed until many, many years later, admitting that Malcolm was right in what he had said, but, quote, he was too far ahead of his time, and you'll get in trouble for being like that. So I just wanted to give you an idea of how I met Malcolm. I was going to a secondary school called Hunter College High School in New York City. And we had a club called the Toussaint Louverture Abyss Ocampos Club, which was about most of the so-called minorities. We were about 5% of the total population of the school. It was mostly Jewish, European Jewish, 90%, about 5% other Europeans, mostly Irish and Italian. And we were 5%, and about maybe 2% of us belonged to this club. And we would have our usual weekly meetings. So when they heard that I live on Malcolm's block, they said, ask him if he would come and speak to us. He said he would, but the deans refused at first, and then they tried to tell us he was not an academic, he was not a good role model, he was a dangerous person, we'd have to get more security, etc. Our advisors also tried to pressure us, but we insisted. So finally they gave us a small room, much smaller than the one we wanted, and we had the talk, but they didn't allow outsiders unless they had student IDs to come into the program. So that was the first time I saw him in a formal setting, and it was very, except in the mosque, I should say. It was very interesting because he essentially gave the same message, the same talk in all the many places I saw him talk, but he would always be very careful to assess the population he was talking to, meet them with examples and in terms that they could understand. He spoke Arabic, he spoke English on different levels. He spoke to Caribbean communities in the Caribbean things that would pull them in and so on. He was, in other words, a person that could relate to any audience. I saw him speaking on the street corners. I heard that he spoke in jail and so on. So it was very impressive to see this person who is different from all the other, quote, big people we had seen, who was simple, humble, talking to anyone, stopping on the street, as someone mentioned before, talking to anyone from a child to a bum, etc. So this was a, you know, a great and very profound and unforgotten lesson to me. All right, now besides that, I'd like to say that in studying African liberation movements, including Caribbean ones, I've been very impressed by the duality of certain things, such as the duality and the way the progressive movement sometimes crosses out certain types of people, including religious people, crosses off and doesn't feel that even mothers with children are serious, leaves out youth until they get to college or become workers, etc. These are some of the things that I think are some of our main problems, and I think some of the things we can learn from Malcolm that he and others that have profoundly affected my thinking were the opposite of. They didn't do that at all. Now, I think that in terms of religion, in looking at the role of religion in marginal, both internal and external capital situations, such as in Harlem and other internal colonies of the United States, such as in Africa or the Caribbean, you can certainly see that a duality. Religion could be seen as both a protest or liberation movement. It could also be seen as a reactionary and accommodationist movement. Religion could also be seen, in terms of the colonialism in Africa and the Caribbean, as an institution of revitalization or one of assimilation. You can look at the role of religion and women within periods of peace as opposed to periods of militarism. You can look at the situation of women and religion in terms of situations of greater democracy and justice, or in terms of situations of more repression and injustice. You can look and see whether women, church people, youth, children, students, were integrated in the processes of change or were left out of the processes of change. Whether they were, things were even explained to them, or whether it was assumed that they could not understand and they should only be supportive. You can look at whether they are forced to create alternative and separate institutions because they're not integrated into those that exist either within the reactionary society of capitalism and colonialism or in many cases within the revolutionary progressive institutions that exist. As for instance in the United States right now, in reaction to the isolation and the oppression of persons of color, minorities, African Americans and others, they have been forced to form and they have been encouraged to form ghettoized institutions that are not at all in any sense equal to or getting even a piece of the pie as some only want, but that are just small imitations of the general society. For instance, if the society is a triangle with the apex at the top representing inequality, theirs is a small triangle at the bottom representing the same thing and usually with the same sort of formation within it. So in other words, these institutions, most of them that are separate, are mostly just replications in a small scale of the general society that they're part of. In fact, that's all they're allowed to be, and when they try to be otherwise, they're severely repressed. We have to look at their leadership. Is it hierarchical? Is it acephalous? We can look at groups like Santeria in New York as well as in Cuba. We can look at the Rastafarian movement. We can look at the Haitian Voodoo as reactionary groups, but you can also look at them as protest groups, as groups that have sought to maintain the cultural identity, the strength of an oppressed people against their colonial masters who wish to impose upon them symbols from their own colonial, from their own experience. In other words, even the symbols we use are the symbols that our movements use or that our religions use. Are they imposed symbols from our colonial past or colonial present? Or are they symbols from our own background? Because just as Father Lucas described the names we have, our symbols are also very important. Do we count off or write off culture as something that is not important because we are giving our great lectures and talking to our, in our party meetings? But what about culture? How can we reach the masses of the people if we don't use culture? If we don't promote the same ideas through music, through poetry? What about illiterate people? How else do they pass on their ideas? So I think these are some questions that I'm not giving you the answers to, but I'm raising because I feel that they're crucial and things we can learn from Malcolm and other similar seminal thinkers and actors who managed to overcome these deficiencies that we still have in our movements. In terms of the relation of the of these institutions and these groups, whether they're of so-called minorities, of religions, of women, or what other oppressed groups, do they have relation with liberation movements, progressive movements? Are they part of them? Or do they have relation to and are they part of reactionary, governmental, and other institutions? We have to look at all of these questions, and especially their funding. Does their funding come from their own people? Are they able to get funding and tax their own people? Or does their funding come from a larger hierarchical institution, like many of our churches unfortunately do, that controls also the way it's spent and what we do with it? I remember the pastor of one church in my city, who some of you may know, and when that person was appointed the pastor of the certain Catholic church, all the symbols in the church represented the European culture, the statues and so on. Surprisingly, they said that there was a hurricane at a season when there are usually no hurricanes in New York. And this hurricane, they said, blew down all the statues and broke all the statues. Well, then of course the people replaced them, and not knowing any better, they replaced them looking at their own, looking like their own images. So now, is this something simple or is this something profound? I think it's something profound. Not naming any names. I think that, you know, these things, we have to look at the symbols. How can we walk around talking about liberating ourselves when we continue to use the symbols that have been so successful by our colonizers? All right, now I would like to talk a little bit about the two religions I'm most familiar with. They may seem like they're conflicting, but that's the ones I'm familiar with, and I would like to talk about them in terms of New York in particular, and Africa also. That is Santeria in New York and Islam. Now, you might say two more different religions you don't want to find in terms of their use or non-use of symbols, in terms of their leadership, in terms of their requirements for members, etc. But in a way, they're very similar also. Both have been used, as I said, both for repression and for liberation. And I hope we can see that it's possible to encourage and work with the progressive end of any of these movements, women's movement, African-American movement, Puerto Rican movement, ex-religious movement. This should be part of our broad front that we need to develop, we need to consolidate, we need to build in every way in order to maintain the gains that we have already gotten and to expand them, and in order not to alienate the masses that do find them useful. All right, not to go into Santeria, because of course Professor Lopez Valdez is the expert in that, and he's given us so much, not only today, but at the first day of our visit here. We've also visited Tata Enrique in terms of both Santeria and Palomonte. So this audience doesn't need that. I would only like to talk about Santeria in relation to the Caribbean community in New York. You could also find similar religions, of course, in both Brazil and in Trinidad, where it's called Xango, Brazil, Macumba, and Candomblé. You can find it in other parts of the Caribbean. In New York, Santeria, the Cuban experience, one aspect of the Cuban experience, has combined with spiritualism, which mainly came in New York from the Puerto Rican experience, so that we have another fusion that you don't have here to the same degree or in the same way. Not that these are combined, but that is the Orisha, camouflaged just as here by the Catholic saints. On the table next to it, you might have, in some cases, a spiritual table, which you all probably know anyway what that is. And these are not seen as in conflict with each other any more than the Catholic saints that are camouflaging the Orisha are seen as in conflict with each other. Now, some people who are practicing the religion or who do it from a purely cultural perspective, some people from a religious belief perspective, some people because it's something that their grandmother always had in the house, etc. But what I'm saying is that this maintenance of this religion and these religions and all religions in a situation of oppression, of colonization, of domination, is one way that the people have maintained not only their identity but their strength. The religion in a situation like New York, where the mostly Hispanic people and others who are practicing it are oppressed by race, class, language, nationality, and sometimes lack of legality. At least five different things that are putting them in a very bad position to be in a society like that. In addition, they cannot openly practice this religion because it's not recognized there, unlike the way it is now recognized here. So Santeria has become, into some, a revitalization movement. To others, a purely, as I said, cultural thing that you keep yourself together. But in many cases, all the religions in a situation like that are religions that are more like social work. In other words, helping people to find jobs, helping people to break out of their isolation, helping people to develop a network of an extended family network because they may have lost the family that they left here or someplace else, helping people to get over losses, helping them to understand the problems they're in, helping them to face reality and to have strength that there's something greater out there that will help them overcome all the injustices we all face in a capitalist society, especially as poor, marginalized, non-white, non-upper-class people. So that these religions are very important in our society in New York for many people. For others, they may look at them like a joke. But I'm saying if we ignore the fact that most people are going to them, perhaps because of belief, but also because of real, concrete, material need, then we are ignoring the fact that none of the social workers, none of the established churches, and the institutions of society are meeting their needs. Santeria in New York is a very strange phenomenon. It's not just Cuban. It's not just Puerto Rican or other Hispanic people. Many African Americans and even some white Americans have joined it. So in other words, this must be providing some sort of function, concrete material function in their lives that is not provided by the political groups, by the other institutions of society. So just to leave that alone for a moment, I'd like to move on to Islam and say the same thing. Islam was not only seen, as some said before, as the antithesis of the Christian colonial experience by some, but Islam was also seen as the development of a community, of a strong family, all of these things that the whole society and the welfare system had broken down so much in our communities. Islam, the certain concepts of Islam you find in Christianity and all major religions, such as the flight from oppression, consolidation, development of alliances, return to the original place, when you're able to do so without fear of being destroyed. All right, this is not very different from the political movements that we know. Flight from Havana, going to the mountains of Oriente. This is the same basic principles that any movement fighting oppression would do. Any movement that is a movement for reform and revolution would have to do if it's going to survive. So what I'm saying is that we need to look at the similarities we have with all of these movements and not just at the differences. We need to have respect for the fact that many of the masses who we cannot underestimate or do not have to assume that they're ignorant and stupid and etc., if they are practicing or find any benefit in these religions, we have to look and see what do they gain from it. We have to look at their role during the colonial period. For instance, Santeria, why was it banned? Why was voodoo banned? Why was Islam banned? Why didn't they want Islamic slaves? Islam was no more powerful than the Akan or the Yoruba or other West African religions. But like Christianity, it was a proselytizing religion, just as it is now in the prisons. If you are Muslim, you go and convert other people. When you do convert somebody, you become an extended family, a community. This is exactly what capitalism and imperialism, which are trying to divide and break us down to the smallest unit, are against. This is why they didn't like Islam, not that it was any stronger than any other West African religion, but because it had that ability to pull together an Akan, a Yoruba, a Dahomean, a Wolof, etc., that are mixed up and broken down away from their communities, pull them all together as one new community, one new force that has a moral, a social, discipline, accountability, belief bigger than the weapons that they lack, that sometimes enabled them to overtake the slave masters. And up to now, they are still being used during the colonial and neocolonial periods in many countries. For instance, in Senegambia, the Morid and Tijan communities were formed, brotherhoods were formed, to fight the French colonialism. Of course, they were banned, their leaders were sent away, they were imprisoned, they did everything to destroy them. But like the Vietnamese, despite their lack of superior weaponry, with that to bind them together, they came back and they still have a parallel economy in a Senegal that is still very much under the French neo-colonial economic system. So like we can look all around, look at democratic Yemen. We can look in Somalia during the earlier period. Of course, this is not to say that there weren't conflicts with some established churchmen, for instance, Somalia. The established church people of that imams were against the change, revolutionary changes brought in the early days by Siad Barre. So that they did everything possible to fight against it and that they were eventually even executed. But that's one end of Islam. The women of Somalia, the progressive ends of the Islamic forces, they were very happy to see these changes coming about. So in summary, I think I'd like to just tell you what some of the lessons I think we can learn from Islam, from this are, and also that Malcolm, the transitions he had in his relations with women, the way women were important to him and the way he was important to them, and the transitions he had in terms of his own development as a person, are transitions that we all need to help each other go through. None of us, including those who feel that we are the most revolutionary, are beyond elitism, are beyond classism, are beyond sexism especially. Sexism is one of the worst things that's drawing us all down. If women are more than half the world's population, it's amazing that even in groups like our own, we always hear sexist jokes, sexist innuendos, and people cannot be seen as objects. How can we call ourselves progressive revolutionaries if we are objectifying more than half the human race? Even if it's just in jest, if it's always done, there's something wrong. We have to help ourselves before we can help anybody else. The lessons that I think we can learn from Malcolm, from Fidel, from Maurice Bishop, from Walter Rodney, from Julius Nyerere, and other such seminal thinkers, are that we have to develop linkages and broad front alliances. We have to use culture, including religion, the arts, and so on, in the promulgation of what we believe in. We have to try to develop personal and social transformations, first within ourselves, and secondly in those that we associate with, based upon our ideology, based upon discipline, and constant and consistent accountability. We have to develop organizational skills and to try to do everything possible in order to break down all of the weaknesses and the lack of humility that imperialism and capitalism have brought to us. Thank you very much.